Schleifer's Construction Profit Series presents Common Elements of Contractor Failure and How to Avoid Them. This six-tape series has been designed so you can use, individually, the tape that most suits your needs based on the problem areas your company may be facing, or used as a complete educational series, aiding in the prevention of potential failure and to help keep your company running profitably. Construction and its related industries now represents close to 10% of the gross national product, some $400 billion a year, with over 1 million individual companies. As a contractor, construction company owner, or general manager, regardless of the type of construction or size of your company, your management decisions alone determine whether you will succeed or fail in the construction business. Now, although there are never any guarantees, the information provided in this series is a direct result from over 1,200 case histories of distressed or failed construction firms. In this series, Dr. Thomas C. Schleifer, one of America's premier experts in management of construction firms, goes beyond addressing the elements of contractor failure. He offers real solutions to very real and too often very disastrous problems. Dr. Schleifer's educational background includes a Bachelor of Science and a Master's of Science degrees in Construction Management from East Carolina University, and a PhD in Construction Management from Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland. Along with over 30 years of contracting and consulting experience, Dr. Schleifer was founder and president of the largest international consulting firm serving the contract surety industry. Dedicating years of research to the elements of contractor failure, Dr. Schleifer found that either alone or in any combination form, there were 10 common elements that were consistent in virtually all of the over 1,200 cases of distressed or failed companies. This fact-finding mission was the direct result in Dr. Schleifer's ability to assist in the resolution or salvage of hundreds of distressed or failed construction firms. In this introduction, titled Construction Business Dynamics, Dr. Schleifer outlines the reasons why subtle changes in a construction organization can have profound effects on the company's future performance. Those reasons are because success in the construction business, past or present, does not imply future success. Because of slim margins. Because of late financial information. And because construction is such a highly credit-centered industry. You need to know the 10 causes are identifiable, avoidable, but take place during profitable years. Generally between the 1 to 3 profitable years prior to the first year of breaking even or profit loss. And now, let's join Dr. Schleifer.
The subject this morning is Contractor's Survival Guide. What we want not to do in managing our companies. The rest of the focus after this would be on what we should do, but we really need to capture what we do not want to do. I consider myself representing 1,200 failed businesses. We're going to talk about includes 1,200 failed construction companies, and all I'm going to try to do is express what those contractors would have said if they were here to tell you what they thought they shouldn't do, to tell you what caused their difficulty. I started to collect this data when I was in a business that I call the failure business. I was in a business where we finished bankrupt or otherwise defaulted construction companies for bonding, construction projects for bonding companies. We did some for banks, but primarily for bonding companies. And as you know, if a company has bonded work and for any reason can't finish it, the surety has a primary obligation to step in. So we would get these jobs in bunches from a failed company. Over the 12 years that I operated that business, there was over 1,200 failed businesses that we came in contact with. I was in that business about 4 years before starting to collect the data formally. But prior to the formal collection of the data that we're going to talk about this morning, I noticed that the causes of the failures of the companies I was dealing with, the various different companies, were similar. They started to repeat themselves. I'd be driving from an airport somewhere on the East Coast to a contractor's office that was in difficulty, and I'd be thinking to myself, this is the same problem I saw in Texas 2 weeks ago. I'd be driving somewhere in the Midwest, And I'd say, this is the same problem I saw in California a month ago. The difficulties the companies were having started to replicate themselves or duplicate themselves. And I said, there's got to be some common threads. About 4 years into the business, we had posted the largest surety loss ever posted in the history of suretyship, which is a record with the company I was with. We broke many times after that, but at that time, it was the largest loss. And the reinsurers got involved in the process. The reinsurers are the companies that insure the surety. They stand behind the surety's obligation. They want to know why this company, this bonding company, was writing bonds right up till the failure of the company. Within the week of when this company failed, they were getting performance bonds, very large construction companies. So we were given the assignment to go find out why this happened. I was glad to get it because I was already informally collecting the ideas and saying, somebody ought to do some research and find out these causes, kind of collect them more formally. At any rate, we leave the meeting. I leave the meeting up in Connecticut, heading for the elevator, when one of the people in the meeting comes with me and he says, I'll tell you why this company failed. I just got the assignment. Now he's going to give me the answer. I'm not going to argue. In some ways, it's how I got through school. I mean, you listen. He says, do you remember the so-and-so job? I said, yep, I remember. He said, they were 23% low on that job. That's why they're out of business today. I said, fine, I'll look really carefully at that. And I got in the elevator and left. I knew it wasn't the so-and-so job because the job he was talking about was 60 or 70% completed. Job wasn't finished yet. Now, they were 23% low, and it was a dog. I want to tell you, they were going to lose money on it. We had already done all of this investigation. What do we know about a job that's 60 or 70% along? It's a cash cow. If it's 60 or 70% along, it's still giving us money. It may be a loser in the end, and it may be a loser on cash, but we've enjoyed the front load that we get in the early requisitions on a job. If we're up past the 40, 50% mark, we're into the big requisitions, right? We're into the meat of the job where we're sending bills in monthly and they're large and we're getting that cash flow. And if we're in financial difficulty, as this company was, we're not paying anybody, right? Labor's up to date, but I'm not paying material. I'm getting money from this job and I'm paying old bills because the company's in financial distress. So no matter how bad the job is, it's a cash cow for sure, at least past the 50% part, and if we're in trouble, we can probably be a cash cow right up to the end. The good news about these failures, they are absolutely identifiable. They're avoidable. That's important for us. That's good news for this audience. That's good news for the construction industry, because if there were some that were the environment we work in, that is, if there were some elements of contractor failure that were the environment we work in, then we couldn't avoid them. We'd be stuck with them. But they're not high interest rates, bad labor market, down market, not even enough work around. Those aren't primary causes. Those are the environment that we work in. And the reason they're not primary causes, the reason I'm certain they're not, is when that happened, an area with a bad labor market, or declining market, or high interest rates, or government regulations, everyone in that area would then fail if those were causes of business failure, because we face those things all the time. Yet, while that's going on in an area, only one company fails, or two. The cause of their failure has to be something different. It's not the environment we work in. And they take place during profitable years. That's going to be the hardest one for me to convince you of. In fact, that's one of the reasons that we're discussing this today with a group of successful companies, because it is successful companies that need to know what to do to avoid the kind of risks that non-successful companies have suffered. It's most appropriate information for successful companies. If a company was already in financial distress, this information isn't going to help them much. I want to do a very simplistic graph to explain this concept or this reality that these causes take place during profitable years. I want to do a cumulative profit graph. I'm going to take my profit in dollars, in money, over time. If I went into business, I started a sheet metal fabricating company or an HVAC company or a dirt moving company, I'm in business 1 year in this hypothetical case, and I make $1,000 profit on operations. I make $1,000 over that which it costs me to operate and my overhead. I'm not talking about gain or loss of sale of assets and depreciation and other financial statement profits. I just earned the money the old-fashioned way, $1,000 profit on the work. I'd go out a year and I'd plot the $1,000. If I was in business another year and made another $1,000, I'd go out 2 years and plot it again. And if I continued to make a profit, this graph would go up. Anybody follow what I'm talking about? It's just a simple cumulative profit graph. Now, if I was in business a year and broke even, didn't make any money or lose any money, I'd add zero to the graph and it would go flat. And then if I continued to have difficulty and began to lose money, I'd subtract from the graph, and if I continued to lose money over time, it would go down. This is an interesting intersection on this graph.
Picture a graph with profit on the vertical axis and time in years on the horizontal axis. The cumulative profit line starts at the bottom left on the horizontal axis and raises steadily, levels off, then drops down again. The intersection being discussed occurs when the cumulative profit line drops down and passes through the horizontal axis or goes below zero.
What it means is that I've managed to lose more money than I ever made in the history of the company. Over 40% of the companies we're going to be discussing in this database passed that point on the graph. They lost more money before they were liquidated than they ever earned in the history of the company. Shouldn't surprise us. Let's do another graph. Let's change the scale on this and just talk about our volume. First generation company, 25 or 30 years. From the start of the company to 25 or 30 years, typical generation. Anybody here start their own business? A couple people have begun their own company. First few years, typically, we're lumping labor. We're lucky in a startup company to make enough money to pay ourselves. It's tough starting up a business. And the day you decide to do it, you have zero volume, so you have to just keep finding work. Typical startup company, if we did just a pure volume chart, we'll go out 5-10 years growing modestly in size, in total size.
Picture a graph with total sales volume on the vertical axis and time from 1 to 30 years on the horizontal axis. The total sales line starts on the lower left at the horizontal axis and rises only slightly over 10 years, covering the first third of the graph.
After getting a foothold, being recognized in their marketplace, they could then start to grow and get into a decent size organization, put on some permanent overhead, actually start making some money.
The total sales line rises more rapidly from year 10 to 20, covering the center third of the graph.
And typical companies that get into the 20 or 30 year range, they actually shoot up in size because now you're really a factor in the marketplace.
The total sales line shoots up dramatically and off the top of the graph.
Well, if I go back here in the first 10 years, the total money that I've earned, if I go to my cumulative profit graph, is not millions of dollars. Right? In fact, some years I didn't do $1 million volume. So my profit's in the tens of thousands, eventually maybe the hundreds of thousands. And now I'm in business 30 years and I have some difficulty. I have some distress within the organization. Things go wrong. In fact, the company fails. That's going to happen when I'm the biggest I've ever been. And my loss potential here, now I'm doing $5, $10, $20 million a year, whatever it is, my loss potential is huge. It's in the millions. And if I go backwards and add these areas of profit in my history, they don't add up to millions. I'm talking tens of thousands, if anything, in here.
The left-hand third of the graph.
Potential profits in the hundreds of thousands.
The center third of the graph.
And at this size,
the right-hand third of the graph.
I'm doing $20 million a year, and I've got great exposure. That's my total sales, not my profit. At $20 million worth of completed work for a distressed or Chapter 11 company can easily cost $3, $4, $5 million over budget. It's strange how our margins are so tight When we sneak up on how much we can make on a job, we're talking single-digit percentages. Sometimes, if we're really working hard, two digits. Right? 8, 9, 10%, 12% would be nice profit. We talk about a failing company that's exceeded 100% of the cost of the work and the work isn't finished. It's nothing to go over by 20, 25%, 30%. Doesn't seem fair somehow. If the downside or the good side of how much our costs below actual contract are is limited, probably to 15, 20%. I don't know anybody taking 50% out of a job. If that's limited to some smaller percentage, then the upside ought to have the same limit. In fact, it seems to me, if we sign a $1 million contract, right? We sign a contract for an owner for $1 million. When we spend that $1 million, we ought to be finished. Right? And if the job's not, we ought to pick up the phone and tell the owner, we're out of here. We spent the $1 million, we're going. But you don't leave, do you? You stay, and then we put our own money into the work, and it's $1,100,000. It's $1,150,000. You're looking at cost reports saying, boy, I hope they're finished out there. I hope they're out of there. Most of our work doesn't lose any money at the 50% point. When my brother and I were in business, a business that he and I started 33 years ago, we never had losing jobs up to the 50% point. Right? Job was always making big profit or better. We were always excited about our young jobs. Then you get up in that 80 and 90%. And I'd be looking at monthly cost reports saying, boy, I hope that job is done. I'd see the cost grow to 98%. And I'd say, I hope they pulled the trailers off that job and we're out of there. And then the cost had run to 103%. And I said, well, it must be done now. Get another monthly cost report. We're still punching out the work. We're at 106% and the job's not done. There's nothing goes bad faster than one of our projects, and we put our own money into it. So it should not surprise us that over 40% of the contractors we're going to be talking about, the construction businesses, managed to lose more than they ever made because of this kind of typical growth. Someone might be thinking, well, if we're talking about bankrupt companies, maybe we're not talking about qualified businesses. We're smarter than those companies. Let me tell you a little bit about this database. All of the companies that are in it that we're going to discuss were over 10 years old. We didn't include any that were under 10 because young companies have a separate set of problems. You've heard or you might have read, companies stay in business 5 years, you'll be in forever. If you're in 7 years, you'll be in forever. In construction, it's more like 10 to be truly tested because there are separate startup problems that are beyond even these 10 common elements of contractor failure that we're going to discuss. So all of the companies were in business for at least 10 years. And successful. That was our definition of success. 44% of the companies were second generation, were older than a generation, and 6% were third generation. The failure in our industry, second only to restaurants, is indiscriminate. It can happen to anyone. That's why we need to talk about these common causes and then avoid them. And one of the problems with the common causes is they sound like good news. There are a lot of champagne corks popped in celebrating one of these events happening to a company. Huge job or way out of town. And we're celebrating this job and later find out that it created problems for our company. Put us in some kind of distress. So we need to be particularly careful not to underestimate the elements as we discuss them. I could start right in and just tick them all off and get into it. Except I need to convince you first why subtle changes in our closely held construction businesses, our closely held construction enterprises, why subtle changes can be so lethal, why subtle changes affect our businesses so much. And there are several reasons. The primary one that bothers me is that success does not imply future success. Some of the companies in the database forgot this. Some of the companies in the database we're discussing thought, because they'd been in business a long time, that they would always be in business, that they were a permanent fixture. Our business is so difficult, your business is so difficult, that if you make money next year in your construction business, it'll be because you owned it. If you make money next year, it'll be because you earned it. It doesn't just come through the door. In our industry, there are no gimmies. I call them gimmies, freebies. No automatics that we get profit without a major effort. Let's contrast that, to understand that further. Let's contrast it with a business we're not. McDonald's. Let's talk about the hamburger business. Anybody remember when McDonald's did not sell breakfast? You go back 10, 15, I don't know, maybe 18 years, whenever it was, when McDonald's did not sell breakfast. They decide to go in the breakfast business. Now, they test it in a few stores around the country. And, of course, they've got 6 or 8, 10,000 stores, whatever number of stores they have at the time. And after field testing, it decide, we're going to sell breakfast. What happens to their overhead? Almost nothing. Hardly any impact. What happens to field direct costs? We're going to have more utility bills because we're going to open the stores earlier in the morning. We're going to have raw material costs of eggs and bacon or whatever else we buy. And we're going to pay some more people to operate the store. In the first year that McDonald's sold breakfast, 29% of their volume came from the sale of breakfast. And not coincidentally, 29% of their profit for that year came from the sale of breakfast. That's an example of success causing additional success. Contrast that with our business. Twin projects. One job that looks exactly like another one within 1 or 2 or 3 years apart. How much do we get for the twin project? More money? Not usually. Let's take an example. Developer comes into town, he's going to put up a 5-story spec office building, buys up a whole city block of property, and you get the job. He rents out the building before it's even finished. It's fully occupied, decides to build. It's 1 year later now. He decides to build a twin office building on the same site. What do you get? Chance to bid it. These guys calling you up and just giving you these jobs. Hey, knock me out another one on the same site and I'll send you a check. Everybody in town thinks you made money. The developer thinks you made money. The guys who competed and didn't get the job are convinced you made money on it. And it's a year later. Materials are up. Labor's up. Everything is up. And you'd like to get more money for the job. Doubtful. As a matter of fact, we're going to rush over and talk to this developer, or the GC, if that's who we're working for, and try to convince him that we're the only person for the job, and I'll tell you the number, it's the same price we got for the other one. If we want more, it's going to go out for bid. If we talk fast enough, we'll get it for the same price, and you know what he's telling you? You have a learning curve. You just did one just like it. It's got to be cheaper for you this time. Anybody noticing that? Twin projects and actual research that I've done across the country built within 2 years typically go for less or the same, not more, when everything goes up. I did some serious research in the early 80s in Texas. Highway Department, Department of Transportation keeps great records. There was very little highway work anywhere else in the country. Early 80s, 1 year after I take these unit prices and get firm prices, and I'm going to make up the years because I don't recall exactly when it was. But for instance, 1980, cost of highway is a certain amount of money. You can take it from their records. That's what we sell highway to them as an industry. We don't use the term selling price, but we ought to think in those terms sometimes. We sell our product to users, to buyers, to owners. 1 year later, cost of highway goes down for the state of Texas. 82, it goes down again. 1983, the cost of highway, unit cost that people are bidding it, is gone down a third time. Material went up, labor went up, and equipment costs and usage went up. And the cost of highway kept going down. We must have been getting smarter, right? I mean, the contractors must have been getting really good at building highway because we can now sell it cheaper. It's not the case. What happened is there was very little highway work anywhere else in the country. So here come all these out-of-town bidders who need work coming in to that locality to show those bidders how to bid. We're so mobile in our industry that if any place slows down, the places that still have work are impacted by our margins, which brings us to the next element or next item we want to talk about is why subtle changes could affect our businesses so much. Slim margins. You didn't have to come all the way here to this conference to be told that our margins are slim. However, the slim margins affect risk. It's a problem for us. Our fathers and grandfathers made more money in this business than we're making. My grandfather was a building contractor in Pittsburgh. I don't think he'd be concerned about any of what we're talking about, because contractors weren't mobile then, and he ran his business season to season. We'll worry about our work this summer. Let's not worry about next year. But in a bad year, when there wasn't a lot of work around, all he did was make less money. In a good year, he made a lot of money. In a bad year, he made less money. It's got a nice ring to it, doesn't it? He made money at any given time by producing his work and selling it to owners, providing it to owners, but he didn't go into a loss circumstance. Today, our margins are so slim that anything goes wrong on the job and part of it's consumed. Two things go wrong on the job and we've got a break-even or losing job. What's the problem with our break-even jobs? They don't contribute to home office overhead. Home office overhead, combined with the slim margins, create a very difficult and unique balance for us to come out year in and year out with a profit. In fact, most of us, if someone would just say, we'll give you a modest profit and we'll assure you'll be profitable for every year for 10 years in a row, we'd take a cut in pay. Right? Anybody sitting here wishing they could get rid of one job out of last year's book of business? Right? You want to be smaller, you're telling me. There's that one job, if you could get rid of it, our margins would go up. That's the problem with these slim margins. It's difficult for us to get an entire year of 8, 10, 22, 50 jobs, whatever your size company is, and have them all make money. We've got to have 90% of them make money and a little extra to pay for the couple that didn't make money. Slim margins create a lot of risk for us. Late information. I know that you're fighting to get weekly labor cost reports to see how the job is doing, and monthly complete cost reports in some kind of timely fashion to be able to use those as management tools and to show them to some of our field people as to how to run the work. But quite frankly, that information is history when we get it. It's a problem for us. Because our labor costs are kept from payroll records, at least those are accurate and we can use them. But our overall costs, materials, stock taken from inventory, fabrication costs, transportation costs, and worse, subcontractor costs or vendor suppliers, material not taken from inventory, we don't get those bills timely. They come in sometime between the 1st and the 10th or 15th of the month, and sometimes not at all. Your accounting department, whether you recognize it or not, has to pick a date when it's going to close its books. And arbitrarily, they say, and rightfully so, on the 15th of the month, we close our books. Does everybody know what that means? That means that on the 15th of the month, we can no longer accept accounts payable. So on the 16th, a subcontractor bill from last month comes in, or a vendor bill from last month comes in, it's going to go on this month. And we might back it in later in the month and get it right, but I've already sent you the cost reports, and it's not in there. Our information is very difficult to collect. It's late. The 15th of the month is ancient history. That's 6 weeks from the first date it's telling us about. I was a superintendent. Ran work back at a time when we didn't even share the data other than monthly. I'd be putting in flat work, trying to get my concrete slabs down and beat unit costs, but I didn't know if I was beating them, because I didn't get any data till the 25th of the following month. And then I'd get this report. And don't you know, I didn't beat unit costs. In fact, I didn't do good at all on my flat work, my flat concrete. But I'm not that worried about it because it's finished, right? I'm doing block work now. And I can hardly wait to see how the block work turns out. Our information is difficult to get accurate and fast enough to manage the work with. So we have to find ways in order to manage that work that overcome the timing and the information. The only thing worse than losing money on a construction project. In fact, you probably thought there was nothing worse than losing money on a construction project. The only thing worse than losing money on a construction project is losing money and not knowing it. there were companies that we're going to be discussing that were in trouble, that were losing money in a lot of places, that were losing money corporately across the board, and did not know it because their books and records said they were not. Their books and records said, you're making money. And then when everything got straightened out and all the adjustments got made and we added back in depreciation and a little bit of overhead that we hadn't charged to ourselves and the real cost of ownership of our equipment, because we've been ignoring that on our interim monthly statements, but now all of a sudden we're going to close the year, well, those costs have to be put in and find out that they weren't making money. I'm not suggesting it would happen in this room. I am suggesting it can happen. It's a problem. The most diligent accounting department of the closely held construction company has difficulty gathering the data. And because we're so overhead driven, and we have to be, we sometimes slim in how many people, how much time, how much money we're willing to invest in collecting that data. The last one is extremely credit centered. Our industry, your company, is more credit centered than you give it credit for, than you believe. Let me try to convince you of that. The companies in this database that are no longer with us, literally hundreds of them, they did not run out of the ability to build the work. In almost all cases, they were losing money. What they ran out of was credit. Obviously, they ran out of cash flow at some point, and most of these contractors put their own money back into the company before they finally struggled. But at some point, they needed additional credit and couldn't get it. For our accounting types in the room, the people from the accounting departments of your companies, I don't have to tell you, and you should tell all the others sitting near you, that if you're in the construction business, you can borrow all the money you need. Everybody realize that? If you own a closely held construction company, you can borrow all the money you need from banks as long as you don't need it. Have you given any thought to how our credit granting system works? You go along year in and year out making money. You're turning in annual financial statements and making money. The bank will lend you all the money you want, except you don't need any money. You're making money. You're profitable. You might want to borrow for equipment. You might need some for seasonal periods to cover cash flow. But basically, you're not a net borrower at the end of the year if you're making a lot of money or it's not a lot. Now, have a losing year. Have a break-even year. By the way, let's do some definitions. My definition of a break-even year for a closely held construction company, particularly if it precedes or it's followed immediately by a losing year, is a year in which we lose money, but not so much that we can't cover it on our financial statements. There's an awful lot of flexibility in our financial statements. And to some extent, we like that so that we can cover something if we need to. But it fools us a little bit. We can fool with percentage of completion. Sometimes percentage of completion fools us, right? I mean, we're trying to do it diligently, and it turns out that it's incorrect. Anybody ever had a job at the 50% point that was going to make bid profit? Right? Bid profit's $100,000. We're at the 50% point, and it looks good, so we book $50,000 profit. We just give it to our books and records. We're supposed to do that. Well, we get to the end of the job, and it doesn't make $100,000. It makes $80,000. Well, we've already taken 50 of it. We can only now back in 30 of it. Or worse, it makes $40,000. It's not a losing job. A job that was going to make $100,000 and still makes $40,000, in a lot of cases, is not all bad. But we booked 50 last year. In order to correct our books and records, we've now got to show a $10,000 loss. For any of you not in the accounting department, you might want to keep this in mind when we're doing our percentage completions. If we've booked more than the job actually makes, we now have to show a loss to back that profit out. That really hurts. And a lot of the companies in this book of business that had break-even years, they weren't really break-even years. They were best foot forward years, I call them. There were years in which we booked a lot of profit that didn't actually develop. Years ago, for those who don't know, we used to be on completed contracts. The job was 90% completed, was going to make a lot of money. We didn't report that profit to our books and records or to the IRS based on the completed contracts method that was acceptable to the IRS. Therefore, we didn't pay taxes. Now it's no longer acceptable. We have to do percentage of completion for at least tax purposes. And since that has come into play as a tax rule, almost all companies go ahead and do their financial statement based on percentage of completion in which case almost all companies go to monthly financial statements at percentage of completion. Yeah, we're booking as an industry. Your company may not be, but as an industry, we're booking every dime of profit. What happens is we should be very conservative on our percentage of completion. We've got a job at the 50% point. It's supposed to make $100,000, and as we look at it, it's probably okay. Question then, do we book $50,000 profit or less? Now, the IRS wants you to book all your profit and pay taxes now, so that's a problem. But quite frankly, if our history shows that we have a little profit bleed, that's the profit that bleeds off in that other 50% of the work. If our historic profit bleed is 8, 10, 12, 15%, then when I'm at the 50% point, I'm not going to claim 50% profit, because I know that on average, most of these jobs will fall apart in the end when the numbers catch up. And we kid ourselves a little bit with the front load. We think we're roughed out, so we've done half the job, and then we find out that 75% of the job is due when the finishes, 75% of the costs. So I generally, if I have profit bleed, would not book all that profit. I'd be conservative and hold back. What's the worst that can happen? It makes a lot of money in the second half. But there is maneuverability. Even when we try hard, our percentage of completion doesn't always give us accurate picture of our financial condition. So, we can borrow money as long as we don't need it. That's the system. Have continuous years of successful construction, profitable financial statements, we can borrow money. But there's no reason to, because we don't need it. Now we have two losing years, break even and a losing year, any combination. We need money. We're running out of cash flow. We go to our bank after two bad years. We're coming into the third bad year. We've given them the financial statement from last year. And typically, they now do not want to lend us money. Worse, they're saying, we not only do not want to lend you money, we want to talk about a payout. We want to talk about a payback situation, because we want to get off this account. You're losing money. You're not profitable. You're not successful. Therefore, we want the money you already owe us back. Worse, your bonding company. How many of us have to have bonding companies where all of our work isn't bonded, but our owners want us bondable? Right? We've got to be bondable, but then they don't buy the bond. But we still need the bond credit. And some of us, all of our work, if it's public and you're prime, all of our work would be bonded. You show the bonding company two losing years. Show them one, you got a problem. What happens in today's credit granting circumstance, and bond, purchasing a bond is nothing but credit granting. It's getting credit, bond credit. You have one bad year, send it off to the surety. We have to show them our financial conditions. And typically somebody's going to show up with a briefcase, wants to talk to you about this. But we're all quick talkers in the closely held business, and we do our dance around, and we say it's this one owner, we're going to get these claims and anything else we can think of, and they usually go away and give us another year of bond credit. That's typically how it works. Now we send them another losing year, and we've got a problem. First of all, we didn't live up to this discussion we had last year that it was a one-time phenomenon and we're going to get out of it and we're going to make money this year. And we've got two losing years, and their credit granting system looks at that and says, we shouldn't be bonding this company. I've seen bonding companies say really obnoxious things like, we realize you're in a slump. I'm not in a slump. I'm gagging here from cash flow. I'm dying. I've had two losing years, and you're calling it a slump. We realize you're in a slump, but we don't want to bond you until you work your way out of this slump. How's that going to work? Now, some of my work's bonded, or all of my work's bonded, and I'm going to work my way out of this slump, and then you're going to give me bonds again. Now, how am I going to work my way out of this slump without bonding? The larger contractors in this book of business, particularly road builders and others that were almost exclusively public construction, the day they lost their bonding was the day they were technically out of business. A lot of them floundered for a while. A lot of them tried for a while. But with taking them out of the bonded marketplace, they were immediately out of business. They just didn't know it. Eventually, they became in the hands of their surety. That way, they met the company that I used to own, and we'd be in there completing the work, and that'd be the end of it. Those companies ran out of credit. In a large percentage of the companies that we dealt with, they ran out of bank credit before or simultaneously as running out of bond credit. What that would mean is they'd have a bad financial statement. Maybe they were turning in interim financial statements. The bank starts to get nervous because what happens when you start to lose money or break even is you borrow additional working capital. A lot of us have, a lot of your companies have lines of credit that are unused. We use it at peak period, and some years we don't use it at all. But in a bad year, we get this line of credit fully out. And maybe we've got another term loan. All of a sudden, the bank is concerned about us because we owe them a lot of money. Then we can't pay our bills. Reputation or rumor goes around town. Bank starts looking at this and gets nervous. A large percentage of the companies that failed that we're going to discuss actually had their bank accounts offset by their banks as the trigger point of them being out of business. But most of the bank, probably all the banking agreements you signed for loans provide a default provision, in which case, if you were in default of your loan provisions, the bank could clean out the money in the bank accounts that you keep at that bank. The right of offset, they call it. In a large percentage of the companies we're talking about, the banks exercised their right of offset, took the money out of the account, and that's the end of that company, unless he goes to his bonding company and says, look, I don't have any money, I can't make payroll Friday. Bonding company steps forward, it may or may not, but if it steps forward and starts providing money, this company's in a claim situation with its bonding company. But a serious problem. For one thing, we're not going to get any more bonds. And we've already lost our bank credit. We are more credit-centered than we give ourselves credit for. We are credit-centered to a fault. Keep in mind when we discuss the common elements of contractor failure that we are not talking about a loss, an instantaneous loss that results from one of these elements that puts us in Chapter 11. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about subtle changes in our business that eventually cause us to have a losing year. We're talking about subtle changes in our business that eventually cause us to have a losing financial statement. A financial statement that shows that loss or break even. And that's once. Now we're entering the next fiscal year of our business. And what do we have to do? Absolutely have to do. Make a profit. We have to, the second year, make a profit because two losing years in a row create credit problems for us. But the problem that this common element started is such that it lasts longer than a year. It wasn't just a little job that lost a little money. It's something that changed the direction of our business and we're currently not profitable. And if that lasts longer than 2 years, we then bump into this credit problem. And the slow demise of companies, closely held construction enterprises, begins from one losing financial statement combined with a second losing financial statement affecting a company's credit, and then it falls apart like a house of cards. So we're talking about trying to avoid anything that changes the direction of our company. Anything that takes us away from what we've been doing successfully. However, that's almost impossible. The marketplace changes. The way we do business changes. Labor changes on us. Technology changes. So we've got to keep changing our company. We've got a problem. We've got to concern ourselves with avoiding the change or managing the change. If we can't avoid it, we're going to have to manage it.